Welcome, folks, to episode 36-39 of the Survival Podcast. This is going to be a really serious episode. I got this guest app a few weeks ago, and I was like, man, we've never talked about this. And I just had one of my good friends go through a very similar situation. We're going to talk about today somebody you care deeply about. In this case, my guest's daughter is overseas, and not like Mexico, Canada from the United States, like way overseas in Asia, actually. And something terrible happens and they pass away. As bad as it is to lose somebody, to then have to try to deal with all of the international components to getting that person's remains safely home so that the family can have, you know, a funeral and a memorial and all the things that we do to process losing someone, that's something we've really never talked about. And it is, it's one of those things like, you know, will you deal with it? Maybe not, but you might. If anybody you care about ever travels outside of the country, this is a very serious subject. And we're going to do our best to talk about it today with our guest, David Cochin, who will be on with us in just a moment. Before we do that, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day today. Sponsor day number one today is Anton's Land of Biltong. I really recommend you check out landofbiltong.com, though the website appears to be down right now. So Anton's Meat and Eat is this other site, and it's up, so that's what I have in the screen. But I can tell you they're still shipping because I got my confirmation that my weekly shipment of Biltong will be here today, this morning, and it made me very happy like it always does. Check out Anton's Land of Biltong. And if you're trying to keep keto, stay carnivore, you can certainly do that with Biltong. It's one of the best meat snacks in the world. Next up today, one thing we all need to worry about is making sure we're drinking the best, purest water we can. And the best way I know to do that is to use the system I use, a Berkey water filtration system. You can get those at usaberkeyfilters.com from Jeff, the Berkey guy Gleason, who's been sponsoring this show since 2010. Need I remind you, it's 2025, so that is 15 years in the world of podcasting. Check them out today. And like all the shortages on filters and everything like that seem to be taken care of, and you can get everything that you need, again, from Jeff the Berkey guy Gleason at usaberkeyfilters.com. Both are sponsors of the day, by the way. Do discounts for you if you're an MSV member, so make sure you take advantage of those, whether it's with our sponsors or any of our supporting vendors. And then just real quick, I want to remind you guys, I am doing a webinar tomorrow, 1 o'clock central time. That's my time, right? So you got to adjust it to your own time zone. And this is with the Price Pottinger Foundation. We're going to be talking about biochar. I'll be doing a standalone presentation for about 45 minutes. When that's over, I will then be interviewed a bit by Nora, who will be my co-host for this, and we'll be taking audience questions for about an hour. So it's going to be very in-depth. I really recommend that you tune in for it. Again, it's tomorrow. And it's at, 1 p.m. Pacific time, so adjust your time accordingly. That will be about 3 o'clock my time for me. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and get our special guest on the air with us now, David Cochin. David, welcome to the show, man.
Thank you.
You've been a long-term listener to the show from your show notes. You started listening to us back, I was still in the car.
Yeah,
driving around. So that's a pretty long time. And I do wish that this show maybe was on a happier topic. But I really want to just, before we even start, just thank you for being willing to have this conversation with our audience so soon after, you know, losing your daughter. So thank you for being here today, man.
I'm glad to be here. And I just want to help other people, if God forbid they're ever in this situation, because it's been tough.
If you could, you know, I used to ask people to tell us about themselves, but since, you know, we're talking about losing a family member, tell us about your daughter. What was she like? What was her name? Who was she?
My daughter's name is Brandy Nicole Cochin. She was our first daughter. She was born on August 10th, 2001. And I just remember Brandy as being very intelligent. As a baby, she learned to talk early. And once she learned to talk, she talked a lot. She also learned to walk at 8 months. Brandy loved to read and write. She took after her grandmother, my mom, Kathy Cochin, because she loved to cook and she wanted to publish a cookbook like her grandmother, Kathy. My mother, Kathy, she wrote the Diabetic Goodie cookbook. My mother has passed like 15 years ago. And she was a type 1 diabetic like my daughter, Brandy. I just remember Brandy loved cooking new dishes for dinner. She was always adventurous with cooking. And she's also adventurous in life. She learned to ride a motorcycle, I think when she was like 19, 20, like I used to ride my bike. She loved to travel. She went to Europe. She was visited France, Great Britain. She also went to Japan, Thailand, and Malaysia. She lived in Cambodia and the Czech Republic. I just remember my daughter, she always liked to help people. She would actually drive around with food in her car and give it to homeless people. My daughter, Brandy, she graduated from Norcross High School and enrolled in Oglethorpe University. She transferred to Maryville University in St. Louis as a senior, where she did online schooling so she could travel. She graduated with a degree in psychology. Her dream was to be a therapist to battered women. She also ran a YouTube channel for over 7 years called Runaway Siren 940, where she had over 7,000 followers. Her YouTube channel covered topics such as feminism, cooking, and travel. And as I mentioned before, my daughter was a type 1 diabetic. I remember, Jack, years ago you were talking about type 2 diabetics and how a type 1 would like to punch them in the face because with a type 1 diabetic, your pancreas does not work. It doesn't produce insulin. So type 1 diabetics, in order to live, they need to take insulin to keep their blood sugar levels in check. My daughter was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at age 3. Unfortunately, when my daughter became an adult, she was reckless with her diabetes, which caused health complications that led to her life ending so young at age 23.
So I was going to ask, and I'm trying to be sensitive to this situation. She was overseas when this happened, but this is not a case of like foreign medical failure. This is a self-management thing gone wrong. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, there was a possibility that her insulin was bad, but yes, she made poor decisions. She should have came home and she didn't. And she died in Cambodia where she was residing.
Okay. Okay. That's terrible to hear. And unfortunately, I also have a connection through family that something very similar happened at a much more advanced age in life, but it was a lifelong poor management decision, and it's too bad. And it really does hit me when I see people with type 2 diabetics going, all you have to do is not do what's putting you here. And exactly. To see people deal with this genetically that have no choice. It really is sad. And I really encourage anybody out there that's got a diabetes problem in your life and it is from lifestyle to realize the gift that you have, that you don't have to live this way, and don't, because there are a lot of type ones that would just change places with you that fast. And they probably despise you for being unwilling to take care of yourself, because there are better decisions that can be made, but it is a horrible thing for anybody to deal with. It really is.
I agree.
So she's overseas when this happened, but she wasn't on like a vacation. She was residing there. How were you notified about this? Like how long after, and who notified you, and was there anything in place in case this happened?
No, I actually had to find out about my daughter. As I said before, our daughter was not taking care of her diabetes. We kept telling her, come home, you need to go to the hospital.
Yeah.
The last time I spoke with her, she had trouble breathing, and I kept saying, you got to go to the hospital. She didn't listen. And on January 9th, the night before, I told her to go to the hospital. So Cambodia is 12 hours ahead of us.
Okay.
So it's, you know, it's a little difficult communicating. So the night before, as I said, she had a trouble breathing, but she decided to come home then, which was nice. But we kept telling her, go to the hospital. And for some reason, she didn't. So on January 9th, I woke up with a bad feeling. We couldn't contact her. So I tracked down her employer. She worked for a nonprofit animal welfare center called PPAWS, Pompeii Animal Welfare Society. I was able to track down her employer on Facebook, and I sent a message to the company. A director contacted me back and messaged me and requested to call me. So she called me around 10:16 a.m., and she told me that Brandy missed her meeting at work, and her coworkers were calling her, but they weren't getting Brandy wasn't answering her phone call. The missed calls. She was missing a bunch of calls. So a couple of her coworkers went to her apartment, and they found her unresponsive.
Mm.
I think she was dead at that time. They called the ambulance, but she couldn't be resuscitated. And then at night, at 6 p.m., the State Department called my wife, Sabrina, and notified her of Brandy's death. And they weren't very helpful. They just said she died of an overdose. And my wife says, no, she wasn't into drugs. She was a diabetic. She had insulin needles. She's like, oh. But they weren't very helpful. So that's how I found out about my daughter's death. It was the worst day of my life.
Now, people deal with losing loved ones. It happens, unfortunately, every day. But generally speaking, the next week is, there's mourning, but there's also like this, I've got to get everything taken care of. And it becomes the thing that helps us. I think, like, I read one time an article about how we do things differently here than they do in a lot of the rest of the world, where some of the Central and South American countries, like, if somebody dies this morning, you're literally doing the burial that evening. And so you don't have that time to kind of process it. And it's a very different thing at a funeral down there, because, like, you know, this woman that lost her husband 4 hours ago is burying him, and it's very hard. But in this situation now, the need is not calling a funeral home and just making a few arrangements and getting family in and figuring out what day. Now, before any of that can even really start, we've got to get somebody's body home from thousands of miles away. And it's not like getting them from Pennsylvania where you just go do it. Like, it's, you know, it can be done. There is international borders. It's complicated. It's probably expensive. I really don't understand what you do. What are the options when this happens?
So if a loved one dies in a foreign country, you generally have three options. You can repatriate the body or the ashes. That means bring the body back to the United States. The second option would be to travel to the country and return with an urn of your loved one's ashes. The third would be to inter the body in a foreign country.
Okay. And what did you choose to do, and what's that like?
We chose to repatriate Brandy's body.
Okay.
Because Brandy said if she did die, she wanted to be buried.
And I think that's even an important discussion to have with your loved ones. What do you want done? My wife and I were actually discussing it last night, and I said, as far as I'm concerned, you can cremate me, or I don't care what you do. And what brought it up is, I didn't know this till recently, like, any veteran can actually be interned at the veterans cemetery in D.C. And she said, do you want that? I said, not really. But I've also determined for me that when I'm gone, whatever y'all do is for you. So I think that, like, having that kind of a conversation isn't something any of us want to do, but it seems really important. And then it will often be the case that your loved ones want to do whatever you want it, right? That's like the one thing left we can do for you. So I would imagine it is more complex to bring back an intact whole body. of a person. What is that process like?
Well, when someone does pass overseas, at first I thought, okay, I got to fly over there and handle it.
It's
not the way you want to do it, because it normally takes 4 to 6 weeks for a body or the ashes to be repatriated to the United States.
Okay.
So, God forbid one of your loved ones, someone's loved one dies overseas, the first thing that you need to do is visit the U.S. Embassy website for that country. And then you need to go, there's a page for like emergency services, and there'll be a link that'll say death of a U.S. citizen. So you want to click on that page. And keep in mind that every country is different in how they handle the dead of expatriates. For example, I had to deal with Cambodia, and Cambodia said it would take 4 to 6 weeks, and there weren't a lot of, there's only like two funeral directors who would be able to handle the repatriation. Now, other countries have better, I guess, funeral services, and there you have more to choose from. I only had two to choose from. So after, if you go to the page and find out where to get started, you want to ask the embassy for help. Generally, you're going to be communicating with the embassy via email. I tried calling the embassy, and the person didn't speak English. So my suggestion, communicate via email, and keep in mind that, I mean, if I'm emailing them at 9 a.m. my time, they're not going to get to that email until the next day because of the time difference, because we're talking 12 hours in the case of Cambodia. And, you know, one of the first things you want to ask is, you know, where is the body? So you can talk to a funeral director of how to move the body to his facility. And then you want to ask them, can you give me a list of funeral homes that repatriate U.S. citizens? You can also need to ask them, what organizations can you help in returning a loved one's belongings? And what you got to know is the embassy is not very helpful. They're not going to help you with really help you much with the process. They're not going to give you any financial help. So you're basically on your own. So that's something to just be aware of, that you're not going to get a lot of help. It's not like working with a local funeral home that has ties to the community and wants to do a good job because they're there to serve the community. This is in a foreign country and they don't care that much. The next thing you want to do, once you do get a list of different funeral homes, you want to contact them and see if they're able to take the body. Because I had a list of three, and two of the three said they could do it. The other one said they were too busy, they couldn't do it. And the reason why you need to work with a local funeral home is because they're going to help you in getting the local authorities to release the body to the U.S. Embassy. They'll also work with the U.S. Embassy to get the death certificate and to authorize repatriation. I had to actually email the Cambodian embassy and says, hey, I want to repatriate my daughter's body. She is working with XYZ company.
Yeah.
And then another thing that's important is you want to find a local funeral home so they can take the body. So you want to go visit a couple of funeral homes and say, are you able to pick up the body from the airport and take it to your facility? So that's important. And then once you get the body back, you want to, you know, plan a memorial service with the local funeral home. We did this after we took possession of Brandy's body because it took like 4 weeks, and we couldn't make funeral arrangements until we knew that we had in possession. So one of the things I just got to remind people is that you got to wait. It's a waiting process. It's not like, as you said before, you could contact your local funeral home. They could pick up the body and you can have a service within a week.
I would say all the times we've had to do it, if we didn't have it the next weekend, that weekend of that week, it was because it was too close and it was the next weekend so that family could travel in and all. But it was like, of all the problems that we had to deal with, that wasn't really a problem. That was like the easiest part, not maybe emotionally, but logistically, you made a few phone calls and things went in motion. Like people, I think when you're in your own country, in your own community and all, like even if that funeral director doesn't know you or anything, there is this like, they understand what they're doing and the situation you're in, and it's, they're professionals and this is what they're concerned with, and they want to do what they can to help you get through that time where you're dealing with people that you're just a foreigner to them. And I'm not putting anybody down or anything, but I like part of it, what I'm thinking when you're saying this is, well, what is the standard, you know, what do most people in that country do when they lose somebody? And if they're primarily like their culture is cremation, and then so you're this foreigner asking for this complex thing that they don't even relate to. Like, you know, and I don't know what Cambodia is like, but, you know, what is the standard practice in Cambodia? If it is something other than what we, most people in America bury the whole body. Mm-hmm. And if it's different, then to them, it's like, you're just being a pain in the ass American. Like, and I know that's a horrible thing, but people rationalize bad shit every day, right? Like they have to go on with their lives. And in the end, whenever you hear somebody died, you feel bad for them, but for if you don't know them and you don't have any personal connection, how long? You know, because it happens to somebody every 7 minutes roughly. So I think that you're just dealing with like this disconnect in that situation.
Yes, in Cambodia, the standard thing is when dealing with a dead person is cremation.
Okay, so that's what I was wondering that. Like, so to them, like, why are we doing all this?
Because he can make money and get paid well.
Yeah. Were the at least the people that ended up handling it for you, do you feel like they did the best they could for you?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. I told you the worst day of my life was finding out when Brandy died. The second was when we viewed the body. The funeral director in Cambodia botched the process of repatriating. Embalming. Yes.
Yeah.
Because the body came in on a Wednesday, and our local funeral director said, "We need to do some work, and we need you to come in the next day." And so the second worst day is when we viewed her body. We had to have a closed casket because funeral director did just in Cambodia did such a horrible job. I'll get a little gruesome. I mean, generally the way the embalming process works is they go through the vascular system, you know, mm-hmm. flush out the blood and replace it with formaldehyde. That's the proper way of doing it.
Yeah.
Doing it. This guy used body cavity fluid, which as the funeral director in the U.S. told me, that's to prevent gases from expanding in a body.
Yeah.
This guy took syringes and injected all over her body in the body cavity fluid. He didn't even change her clothes. And then he didn't even put a pillow or it's called a head block underneath the head of the deceased. And my local funeral director, he said it was the worst job he's ever seen. When they saw her body, her mouth was open, her eyes were halfway open, and her head was partially back. It was that bad. I didn't see that. They tried to do some work, but when we, you know, Sabrina viewed her body, it was livid because he could have done a better job. And there was one other funeral director that could have handled the embalming process. And that guy told me that the guy who did our embalming, he wasn't good at it. And I just thought he was trash talking because, you know, one competitor talking about another.
Yeah.
And I even asked the embassy and said, I'm choosing between these two guys, which one is better for repatriation of the body? And they says, we can't tell you who's better, but people have used both. That wasn't helpful.
Well, that's not helpful at all. No.
No.
And it's not something you get Yelp reviews on or something like that. Like,
yes.
Is there anything that you can do to make this process easier, whether after the fact or in preparation for the possibility?
One thing, I mean, lean on friends and family. This is the time.
Yeah.
do that. And ask about the embalming process if you're repatriating the body, because they need to go through the vascular system. This is, that process is not something that's new, that was like 5 years new. This has been going on, you know, for close to 100 years of going through the embalming through the vascular system. And then also ask for help from the deceased loved one's friends, like that are over there. For example, I'd like to publicly thank, her name is Christian Air Sang. That was one of Brandy's friends in Cambodia. And, she was a huge help. She, retrieved Brandy's belongings from her apartment and from the embassy and was able to pack it up and send it to us. So that was a very big help. Because if we didn't have her help, we'd have to hire someone that wouldn't even care. So, don't be afraid to ask for help of your loved one's foreign friends. The other thing is you're going to need to buy a scanner for your computer, because you're going to have to email important documents to the embassy and to the foreign funeral director. You're going to have scanned copies of your passports of the parents of the deceased. You have to scan in a notarized affidavit of next of kin that you have to send to the embassy so they can go and create the death certificate. So if you don't have a scanner, you can always go to a FedEx office or a UPS office and have it done, or go to a friend, but it's helpful to have a scanner.
You mentioned passports. Like, what's occurring to me is there's a lot of people don't even have a passport. Like, I mean, would their state issued ID work? I mean, how?
We had passports, so but I was thinking the same thing. Like, not everyone has a passport.
Yeah.
I guess they would probably take state issued ID of a driver's license, maybe a birth certificate.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems strange that it takes so much effort to do this. I understand there's like some concern, like, do we release this body to these people? But it seems obnoxious that, like, okay, once it's verified this was your daughter and she's here, it would seem like everything possible to expedite that process should be done. And it's clearly not. Like, there is a plane, a cargo plane or something, that could fill this role. And it's like there's bureaucratic BS involved in one of the few places in the life, you know, that you would think, let's kind of forego this. But I guess not. And I guess we should say for other people out there, like, this experience could be totally different in a different country. And sadly, I guess there's really no way to know unless you have to deal with it.
Yes, that's correct.
What did you learn from the whole thing? Like, if you were advising people today and they have someone living abroad or traveling abroad, like, from this whole thing, what would your advice to them be? Not after it happens, but in case it happens.
Well, don't expect much help from the U.S. Embassy, number one.
Okay.
And expect that there's going to be a waiting period that's a month to a month and a half in order to get the body or the ashes repatriated. Another reason why we chose to repatriate the body, it was only $3,000 more to bring the body back versus her ashes. And repatriation is expensive. For example, I paid $9,500 to have her body repatriated to the United States.
So for what you just said, if they had shipped an urn, that would have still been $6,500.
Yes. So, I mean, at that point, I'd rather have a funeral service.
Yeah.
And a viewing. Unfortunately, yeah, we couldn't have a viewing because he did such a horrible job. Also, I mean, funerals are expensive via stateside, or even bring a body back. For example, in addition to the $9,500, we spent $14,400 on a burial and $10,000 for the funeral service stateside. And then we had a repast to honor her after the funeral, and that cost about another $2,000 or $2,500. So, like I said, when someone dies, it's expensive. And one of the biggest things I learned is about this whole process is you learn who your friends are. You know, people show up and they're there for you.
That losing someone in your family or a really close friend shows you exactly who you can count on. It's to a level beyond moving. Like the people that show up when you move, they pretty much have your back. But the people that show up here, they really have your back. And it is a terrible situation. You know, a lot of people are doing this, though. They're choosing to go live abroad, you know, whether it's permanently, semi-permanently, or even like a lot of young people are like, I'm going to go live in Europe for 2 years or, you know, whatever. And, you know, somebody wanted to do that that was a younger person in my family, I would encourage it. But this makes me think about it differently because in your case, it was diabetes, but it could have easily been getting hit by a car.
Yes.
Right? I mean, like people die. No one wants to think about it. Because it's a terrible thing to think about. And to think about a child dying is way worse than thinking about like a parent or a grandparent dying, because fathers and mothers are not, we're not supposed to outlive our kids. That's like the last thing we want to do, really, you know? So you've got a loved one that wants to go live in a foreign country for an extended period of time, then this is a possibility. Is there any advice you would have for somebody in that situation? Maybe not the person going, but the person staying here.
I'd suggest taking out a term life policy on them.
Okay.
$50,000, just because, I mean, if you don't have that lying around, where are you going to get the money?
Yeah.
So I would start with that. Another thing, when the traveler does decide, you know, goes overseas, you need to have them registered with the U.S. Embassy. So God forbid something happens to them, they know who to contact of next.
And it sounds like your daughter had done that.
Yes. Yeah, she did that. Yeah. And also when they're overseas, if they're living there and working, you need to get their employer and residency info, you know, including you need the contact info of the landlord and their boss. For example, our daughter told us where she was living, but she never gave us her landlord information. Mm. So we lost most of Brandy's belongings because the landlord cleaned out her apartment and disposed or stole most of her stuff. The
was the right word.
The what?
I think stole is the right word. I mean, when somebody passes away, you know that what they've left behind might be important to their family. You know that. You're not confused by that.
Yeah. However, the police did take her valuables, like her electronics,
okay,
and her IDs, and her phone, her computer, Kindle, Xbox. So they did take that. And then, as I said before, her friend Kristen Ayer was able to pick up those items from the embassy. I had to email the embassy and say, this lady is coming to pick up her belongings. Another thing that's important when a loved one goes overseas is, you know, get the names and contact info of her friends and coworkers. I mean, basically, because if you're having trouble reaching your friend, I mean, your loved one or a friend, you could tell them, hey, can you go check on Brandy? Is she okay? And Brandy didn't give us that. And in retrospect, I thought that, you know, hey, if Brandy did give us information about her friends and her coworkers, we could have contacted them prior to her dying, and maybe she could have been saved.
Yeah, maybe if somebody would have showed up and said, listen, your dad just called me, we need to go to the hospital now, she might have went, right? Like,
yes.
Sometimes your friends have more influence on you than your – in fact, many times, especially a 20-something, your friends will have greater influence on you. And, I mean, I know of one instance where a guy didn't show up from work, and, like, the network of friends – activated, and they found this guy on the floor, and he would have died if that didn't happen. And like nobody from work gave two shits. It was like somebody at work told somebody else, and they're like, that's not like him. And I won't get into it because it doesn't matter. I'm just saying, like, that network of friends, that might be one of the most important things you said, because it might not be a death. There's a lot of things that can go wrong when somebody's that far away from you. And even if it doesn't change the calculus, the ability to gain information, because I've been in situations like this where what do I do? Right. And there's no one you can talk to, and there's nothing you can do, and it's a very helpless feeling. And so I'd say, like, that needs to be a plan for anybody traveling abroad long duration, with even an agreement like, I'm not going to interfere with your life. This is in case I can't reach you. That seems really important. The other thing you mentioned was life insurance. And it would seem like if somebody's going to go live abroad for 3 years, you know, 3 or 4 year term life, pretty inexpensive on a young person, by the way, makes a lot of sense. Did you have any on her? And is there any issues with that insurance policy being paid out when you actually need it? Because there isn't a body, because the body's in Cambodia or wherever it is. Like, you know what I mean?
We did not have life insurance on our daughter. I was thinking about doing it, but I kind of felt like I didn't want to be gambling on her life.
Yeah, yeah.
But if I could stress, when young people go overseas, get the term life insurance. It's cheap. When you are dealing with a funeral home, if you don't have the money, as long as you have a valid policy, they can do something where they can collect, be the first to collect money from that policy. So they can help. You don't have to have the money up front if you're dealing with that.
I got you. It's just one of those things I've never really thought about. Like, because one of the things that we've had to do when we've dealt with this is provide a certificate of death to the insurance company. And really, that's a phone call, and the coroner or the hospital or the funeral home does it for you. But it just seems like this would be a different situation. And I don't ever want to defend insurance companies, because they're some of the worst people in the world in some ways. But you can understand an insurance company saying, we're not paying out a life insurance claim until you can show us that this person has actually passed. And when that person is 4,000 miles away, you can understand that an insurance company might be like, hey, it's not like we're not willing to do it, but, you know, we need this proof or what have you. And maybe a phone call is not enough. And so that's something people should think of too. The landlord thing is really interesting to me too, because you don't know who that person is, right? Even if your loved one gives you their contact info, you don't know them. I mean, most of the time I didn't know my landlord anyway. I just, you know, paid the rent. Like, I didn't know, the girl at the office of the apartments, it wasn't my landlord. She worked for my landlord. The landlord's the owner. And then you mentioned police secured the valuables. That's great that happened, because I've been to countries where the police would secure the valuables. I promise you, they would secure them, and you would never, ever hear about them ever again. They'd be like, we don't know. Like Panama, I hate to say negative things there, but the Panamanian police were all about what they could get from anybody that wasn't Panamanian. And they were pretty corrupt there too, but definitely like an American was just seen as a piggy bank. They'd shake you down for money, and somebody that would shake you down for money on a traffic stop, I have no doubt would take a deceased party's possession. So I think it's also an important thing that maybe people have a better understanding of, like, what generally does happen in this particular country when this occurs.
Yeah, I agree. Other things I suggest is set up a means to communicate. It's a lot easier nowadays because we don't have to send letters. We got computers and applications to do that, smartphones. I'd also suggest, getting scanned copies of their passport and driver's license. So if you have to deal with getting the body back or her belongings, you can show her, here's her passport information. I'm the parent. Here's my passport and affidavit and so forth. Another thing people don't think about as well is you have to tell them that, we don't want this information unless it's an emergency or you die. You should probably try to get passwords to their computer, phone, banking information, PayPal. And the reason why I suggest this is because Brandy had a bank account. She didn't have much money. She had a bank account in Cambodia. I contacted their bank, showed them all this information of proof of death and showing I was the parent.
Yeah.
I contacted them via phone, via Facebook Messenger and email. And they says, no, we can't give you, we can't transfer the account. You have to come in person. And I was telling them, I'm in the United States.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fortunately, we did have her passwords, and I was able to get into her phone, and on her banking app, I was able to wire what little money she had to us. So it's just something to think about. I mean, there has to be trust between your loved one, saying, you know, we're not going to want to pry into your life, but, you know, God forbid something happens. If we have the passwords, it's going to be a lot easier to move funds out of that country back to us than us having to go travel over there.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, that makes me think of, like, maybe there's some way to do something that's kind of like what we, in crypto, we call it a multi-sig, where that person could have a friend that has some sort of a password, but they don't know where to put the password. Right. Mm-hmm. So they have this data stored digitally somewhere, and you know where it's stored, but you don't know the password. And the friend knows the password, but not where it's stored, with the instruction of, if something happens to me, give this information to my parents. Right. Something like that. Because, you know, I think about this, like, can my son trust me 100%? Do I want access to his bank accounts and all this other stuff? I don't. I don't want it. I don't want it. I don't even want to, like, to be tempted to look at it and then start judging him as a father. Is he managing his fund? I don't want it. But I would, in that situation, I would want access to it at that point, because all the reasons I don't want it are gone now. All I can do now is what's right by my heir, you know, my deceased child. Like, yeah, I that's one of the, and then you mentioned, like, getting things done. Like, one of the things we did as my father-in-law was in decline was we had a power of attorney drawn up. And it would seem like that would be a reasonable precaution, is that if someone's traveling abroad like that, long duration, especially, some sort of limited power of attorney under certain circumstances. But I don't, the other thing about that is now you're in a whole different world. Like, I know for a fact, if I have a power of attorney in the United States and something happens in the United States and I give that power of attorney to the bank, it's like, okay, now I'm that person and I can do whatever needs to be done. I would say you probably would want to consult with some level of attorney with expertise for that jurisdiction onto any sort of power of attorney, because what's worse than not having something is believing you have something and you don't.
Yes.
Like, think like, oh, this won't be a problem, and it turns out that that piece of paper means nothing in this other country.
I agree.
Yeah. Yeah, it would seem to me like one of the best things people could do in that situation would be, maybe their banking needs to be domestic, like, you know, and available internationally, because I've never had a problem using my domestic bank account internationally. But I guess there is a case for having local bank relationship as well. I don't know. Do you have any advice, like, for, like, we've come at this mainly from your perspective right now, the person that's back here, whether it's the child or the parents or a friend or a brother or whatever traveling. What about the person that's actually making the decision to live outside of the U.S. for a time? Like, do you have any advice for what they should do?
Yes. I mean, tell them that they're always welcome to come home. You don't have to try to, you know, prove something. And then, you know, tell them to put their health first. My daughter, for being such an intelligent young woman, she was very reckless with her health. I mean, you know, I remember having a conversation with one of my friends, and he says, I don't understand. She was reckless with her health, but she was very, very bright. And I said, I agree. I can't figure that out. Another thing, just keep in touch so people know that you're alive, you're doing okay. And that's a lot easier to do nowadays than in the past. And then, you know, heed your parents' advice. I mean, that's something for people who don't leave the country either, because a lot of young people think that their parents don't know anything. And, like, yeah, we're older than you. We have more wisdom. You know, we want you to succeed.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think a lot of times, too, a person that maybe is in that situation of going abroad, part of what they're doing is creating separation for whatever reason they have, right, and they want to do it themselves and whatever. And it's, I would say to the person doing that, that's great. And if that's what you want, pursue it. But understand that, like, there is nobody in the world, you know, 99.9% of people anyway, that will do more for you to help you than your parents. Right. And exactly. There are people that's not true about. And that's not true in my world. Like, as I'm saying that, I realize, like, it doesn't apply to me, but it does apply to me with my son. Mm-hmm. Like I will slaughter dragons for my son. There is nothing that I wouldn't do to help him if he was in a situation and needed my help. And I think that like young people get in this stage, and it usually seems to run about a 10-year stage where like they forget that. and don't, because no matter what you think about your friends or whatever, they will never do for you what your parents would do for you. You know, with, again, I will acknowledge some rare exceptions, but you know, that's a person that the parent is damaged. Let's just put it that way. Right. Like any sane person, tell me what I got to do. If me cutting my hand off will save my son, I'll do it right now. Right. I mean, like that is, and how many people would do that for you? And I think like if you're traveling overseas, like this is something you should be thinking about, not just the people you're leaving behind, like making sure there is something in place so that your family, your friends, whoever's there that can take care of this part of things is notified and as much is given to them as possible from the people that you can count on where you're at. Because, and I think we all have a hard time with this. I think there's a part of the human mind that has a difficult ability to comprehend our own death. Like, well, not me. Well, everybody's going to die, but are you going to, yeah, you, me, no, I'll die. Well, someday, right? And I think we do get more in touch with it as we age.
Right.
But, you know, when I was your daughter's age, when she passed, I was rock climbing and jumping out of airplanes and riding motorcycles. Like the concept that I was mortal to me at that point was ridiculous, right? Like 20 years, like I'll be 43. Who gives a shit, right? I'll be young still. Now I'm sitting here going, well, in 20 years, I'm going to be, oh, shit, right? Like, I might not be here. And I think that if you're going to make this life choice, then you need to kind of accelerate your mindset to that I am mortal reality and have some level of a plan for it. Because, you know, I've heard it put this way. Like, when you're dead, your problems are over, but the people you leave behind, they've just begun. And like that's part of being a responsible adult is thinking about who you will leave behind.
Yes.
You know, is there, when you have people in these situations where they're far away, like, are there certain ways that you can make sure you communicate with them more? You know, I mean, long distance calls are not really is the problem they used to be, but it still can be somewhat expensive, but ways to make sure you stay in touch so that, you know, if something's beginning to become a problem, maybe you know about it before it does.
Yes. There's basically like three cheap ways of communicating with people who are overseas. Facebook Messenger is really good. I mean, just for messages, I mean, like text messages, and you can also do phone calls. WhatsApp is another one. That's an app you can put on your phone. And then lastly, if you want to do actual phone calls, you could use Google Voice to make international calls. And that's only like 15 cents per minute. And I mean, that's one nice thing about technology nowadays is even though, you know, your friend or loved one is a continent away, it's a lot easier to communicate than it was, you know, 30 years ago.
You know, I do have a friend who is domestic and he's not big on texts and calls and stuff like that. And he travels a lot domestically, but he travels a lot and he has some serious health issues. And I'm like, I don't give a shit what you do. Post something on Facebook every day.
Yep.
Or just post something. You have to totally post it to me. I don't even use it, but I'll look it up and I'll check your profile. And I ain't heard from you in a while, but you checked in at Bucky's and you were buying beef jerky. Good. Like, and I'm like, if you don't, I'm going to fucking send a search party out after your ass. Like, I think that, like, we tend to zone in on where we're at, and then we, like, I'm not worried about, like, they know I'm fine. Well, they don't know you're fine, especially if you have a health issue. Like,
yes.
I mean, you had to know this could be a problem, like, even before she was telling you there were some problems. Like, I've never met a diabetic who took their condition seriously that didn't, that wasn't in touch with the fact that things could go catastrophically wrong very, very fast.
Yes.
Like that's actually the only way that you can be taking it seriously is to accept that. Like, because there are a lot of people out there that are type twos, and you know, maybe they're not full tilt as bad as it gets yet. And if they don't really take care of themselves, well, that could go sideways, but it may not. Where if you're type one and you don't take care of yourself for even a couple of days, you can end up just catastrophically dropping off a cliff, like over minutes almost, you know. And I did find it interesting the State Department said she overdosed. And that's something that I've seen a lot of with diabetics. I remember one gentleman I worked with, he ended up in a diabetic crisis, and you can actually have breath that smells like you've been consuming alcohol in that situation. And he almost lost his job. They just assumed he was drunk at work.
Oh, wow.
And what it was is he had, I don't know what he did, but he took the wrong dose of like too little insulin. And he ended up like in a crash because of that. And he was slurring his speech and they got him off. But it took some effort from us on the crew that worked with him saying, this dude's diabetic, because the people that we worked for were ready to terminate him immediately. And so, you know, maybe that was part of the local prejudice, I guess, against a foreigner that like, oh, it's an overdose.
It's an overdose.
Yeah, it's an overdose of sugar. You know, basically is what that would be. So I appreciate you being with us today. Is there any more advice you have for people as we wrap up here?
Not really. Just, you know, be thankful for your loved ones and tell them you love them and, you know, try to stay in touch.
Yeah.
And, you know, tell the young ones, you know, people in their 20s. Yeah, you think you're invincible, but you're not. But, you know, go ahead.
Even if you have no health issues, like I had a friend who died in high school in a car accident, and it wasn't nobody was drunk, and it was just a freak accident. Like, and the person in the other vehicle ended up severely handicapped for life. And both of those people and their families' life altered in seconds, and nobody really did anything wrong. It really was kind of a freak situation that just happened. And I do think it is very difficult as a young person for you to realize, and I think intellectually we know, well, that happens, but not me. And I think that is a very, in some ways, it's a healthy self-defense thing. Like, if you walked around worrying that today was the day you were going to die every day of your life, you probably wouldn't see 25 before you'd have some sort of stress-induced heart attack or something, right? Like, we have to, on some level, block that out. But then from a practical standpoint, we also need to be thinking about putting things in place. And I would tell you guys listening to us today, like, if you're like, well, this doesn't apply to me because we're not going to travel overseas. Well, maybe, but you don't know that, right? But the other side of it is, but you will deal with death. You will deal with death in your life. And things like life insurance, and I've had that as part of my preparedness strategy for people. As you know, since 2008, like, the pragmatic, boring things are often the things that are the most important and overlooked by people that call themselves preppers, because you talk about the shit hitting the fan. When somebody you love dies, the shit just hit the fan for you. Yeah. And that's where I've tried to say, you know, almost every day I've ever done this show, like, the shit hits the fan for somebody every day. And sooner or later, you'll be that person. And or someone you love will be that person because you're the person that's gone. And I think that, you know, things like having prearrangements for your funeral as you get older, that is something that, you know, people should look into. We've done it like as best we can anyway. I've tried to come to grips with what I want is nowhere near as important as what the people I leave behind want. Like, that's actually the more important thing to me. But, you know, making sure that they can do as little as possible when they're dealing with the fact that I'm gone. And nobody wants to talk about this. No one wants to think about this. And I think we've come really far in that direction to the negative, because I remember when I was a little kid, I'm talking like I was like 12, and there was this gentleman that lived a few houses north of me. His last name was Debsky, and he was like 96 years old. And he was part of the whole community that moved there from the Ukraine. And him and his wife, again, were in their 90s. And I know I'm sitting up there with him one day, and we're picking raspberries off his bushes and stuff like that. And he's just hanging out with a kid, you know, and this guy's honestly kind of like an adopted uncle. And one day he just says to me, he goes, yeah, I'll be dead soon. Right. And as a kid, you're like, what do you mean? Right. He's like, I'm 96. I'm 96, and when I think about that memory, I think about how my great uncles, my grandparents, and all, they talked about their eventual departure, and I feel like even the elderly today don't do that anymore, and I don't know that it's the best thing for society, because it leaves us in a lurch when it happens. There's no expectation. And do you really think a 96, like if you're a life insurance company, you know, you're not insuring a 96 year old person, right? You're not, can't help you, right? Like, yeah, we're betting you're going to live longer than you think you are. And in this case, we think we'll lose. So we're out. And we do need to think, I think, more about like our final chapter and realizing that can come, unfortunately, when we're much younger than we would expect it to. I know this couldn't have been easy for you today. I really appreciate you being with us and having this discussion.
Thank you.
Is there anything else you want to say before we wrap?
Yeah, I just hope, God forbid anyone is in this situation, you know, hopefully something can help you make the process a little easier. It's never going to be easier. It's very, very difficult, but that's it. My only reason for coming on this was just to help other people if they're ever in such dire need.
Yeah, I think you're right. It will never be easy, but it can be harder. And so if we can do something to make that not happen, that's probably a good idea. Thank you, David, so much.
You're welcome.
All right, guys, let's wrap up. I want to tell you, I appreciate y'all for tuning in today. This was probably not an easy discussion for David to have with us, but it's an important one. And I encourage you to think about this subject, not just in the specific way that we looked at it today of everything's harder because the person that you care about that passed away is in another country. And that is why we had this discussion today, but it's not like it's easy when they're not in a foreign country and planning for our eventual transition to whatever comes after this life is something we all should probably do a better job with, even though it's not something we want to think about, you know? Anyway, with that, I really appreciate everybody for tuning in today. Thank you for that. I want to remind you guys, one of the ways you can help support the show is do your online shopping at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Today's item of the day is the Gator Propane Weed Torch. I brought this around today just because this is the time to get the gardens ready, right? Spring is springing. It hasn't sprung, but it is actively springing as we go right here. And your garden might be just piled with weeds and dead things. And mine was, and all I did was remove my irrigation so I didn't burn up my pipes and take this torch. And in a few minutes, all of my beds were prepped and ready to go. Fire is an ancient method to prepare things for agriculture. And I really recommend you check this torch out. And remember, it's a torch. So yes, it burns weeds, but it does a lot of other great things too. Whenever I'm firing up the biochar kiln, this is what I use. If we're just making a fire in the pit for the kids to hang around or whatever, this is what we use. Check it out. Very, very affordable, super high quality. This is my second weed torch that I picked out. The first one, honest to God, was crap. It was just crap. And it literally fell apart over 6 months. From the time I bought it until I finally threw it out, it was falling apart a little bit more every day. This thing is built like a tank, and it costs like a third less than the one that failed me. So definitely check it out. Remember, you can always help us out no matter what you buy. You start your online shopping at tspaz.com. Thank you guys for tuning in today. I really appreciate that. Remember, I am doing the biochar webinar with Price Pottinger tomorrow. I'd love for you to be there. 3 p.m. Central, 1 p.m. Pacific. I guess that's 4 p.m. Eastern. All you got to do is click the link and sign up for it. It's completely free. Take care, guys. I'll catch you tomorrow with an expert counsel Q&A show for the week. Around. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way. Let me show you a better way.